Bristol Community FM.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The BBC didn't say a word this year about NATO and the bank's most powerful annual gathering. Their Barclays Bank chairman, BBC trustee, was inside with bankers, royalty, or should I say banksters, royalty, oil men and the military. But as the London Evening Standard revealed, he and the corporation want to keep it hush-hush. Well, why would they want to do that? We review the weekend before last's Bilderberg conference, the secret rulers of the Western world. And the McNulty report into the railways is recommending that privatised train operating companies should be able to charge what they want, meaning fares will go even higher. Well, that's good news for the oil companies, but what will it mean for the rest of us? And big changes being mooted to fishing rights around the villages of the South West Coast. We have Wilf Mound from Bristol Greenpeace in. But first, Democracy Outside, a street performance of live democratic dialogue. This is a public event which is taking place tomorrow at 2 p.m. in the centre of Bristol, opposite the Hippodrome. Do you feel like democracy's got stuck, trapped in institutions? Well, we do, separate from the real people in daily life. Do you get frustrated by the way that political debate just seems to be black and white, left and right? Right, I'm right and you're wrong, that no one's really listening to each other, there's no room for movement? Would you like to be part of making democracy fun? Well, Democracy Outside's a free interactive public performance about democracy in which everyone takes part and everyone gets a chance to speak if they want to. It's part street theatre and part political action, blurring the boundaries between art and activism, challenging apathy and bringing democracy alive. And it will move you, literally. The performances will last 1 hour and we need you to be involved. Like democracy, it works best when everyone engages, challenges each other and opens up new ways of thinking. So come to join us, play politics. We all have one power that can't be taken away, the power to imagine. So that is tomorrow, a public event at 2 p.m. in the centre, and it's just opposite the Hippodrome. So, Martin, world affairs this week. Let's just take our little tour around briefly. We'll start, I think, with what's been going on in Syria, and particularly this fascinating article. You sent me an article which is throwing doubt about the Homs massacre actually being committed by the Assad regime.
It's not the Homs, it's the Hula massacre.
Sorry, Hula.
Yeah, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is the German Daily Telegraph, if you like, have done exhaustive research, including speaking to refugees from Hula, and they are saying that it's pretty clear that in actual fact it was the rebels that carried out the massacre of people in Hula and not the Assad regime.
So how do we make that mistake then?
Well, I don't necessarily believe that, nor do I necessarily believe what we've previously been told, but let's put it this way. The Hula massacre was used by the Western powers to make a démarche at the United Nations, a diplomatic manoeuvre, whereby they demanded that Assad would have to go and the Russians and the Chinese would have to do something now after the Hula massacre, because it was so terrible that Assad had carried it out and he was a terrible, terrible man. Now, that the coordination between what the Western powers were saying and the massacre itself, if it was the rebels that carried out the massacre, and the Catholic Church in Syria are saying that it was the rebels, as are the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is the German Daily Telegraph, if it was the rebels that carried it out, the question then has to be, were the rebels coordinating the massacre of Alawite families and pro-regime families with the Western powers who were putting forward their resolution at the UN at the same time? It could well be that the Western intelligence services are behind the Hula massacre, not the Assad regime at all. Now, when the Assad regime was being talked about by being behind the Hula massacre, we were talking about the International Criminal Court for Assad. If British intelligence or US intelligence or Israeli intelligence or Turkish intelligence officers and politicians are behind the massacre, surely the point has to be that they are to be sent to the International Criminal Court. Surely, if that's what's proved.
Well, one of the things I don't quite understand, Martin, is the way that the Al-Qaeda seems to have turned from the biggest enemy of the West, and suddenly it's in Libya and Syria. It's part of the... it seems now the Al-Qaeda in these countries is actually some kind of ally and doing what the West and NATO want.
They always were, the Islamic fighting group.
But how has that happened? How has that...
Because remember what Al-Qaeda is. As Robin Cook said when he was Foreign Secretary many years ago, Al-Qaeda is simply the database, a database on a hard drive that was held in Amman, Jordan, listing all of the Islamic extremists that had been recruited by the Western intelligence services to fight with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. That's where Al-Qaeda came from. It was set up by the Western intelligence services, and in my view, it's always been manipulated by the Western intelligence services all the way. There's never been a point where the so-called Al-Qaeda franchise was not having its strings pulled by Western intelligence. And that's what the Russians are openly saying these days. They're stopping pulling their punches.
Drive Time on BCFM. 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, what would you do if you had a nice career as a senior civilian intelligence officer for the police and as part of your work came to the conclusion the real threat to Britain came not from Islamic terrorism but from false flag provocation attacks paid for by the military-industrial complex and carried out by so-called friendly mercenaries or special forces? That Western intelligence services, particularly NATO and Mossad, had a history of such self-harming attacks on their own people, much like attacks Colonel Gaddafi of Libya was and President Assad of Syria is now being accused of carrying out. What if you believe that a secretive fascist New World Order was generating a domestic terror threat and that new laws for state intrusion into privacy and ending fair trials, the very civil liberties that have been so hard fought for over the centuries here in Britain, served this New World Order's purposes very nicely? Would you risk your career by telling your senior officers and the Home Office, or would you keep your mouth shut? If you chose to speak out in modern Britain, you could expect to be either ignored by the mainstream press or possibly pilloried in the Sun or the News of the World. Well, he was both. I'm talking about former senior intelligence and threat analyst at South Yorkshire Police, Tony Farrell. Well, hi, Tony, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony, and thanks for having me on.
Now, tell us about the point where you decided enough was enough for you and you couldn't go along with most of the rest of your profession on the whole Islamic terror threat.
Right, it was the 1st of July 2010, threat assessment matrix, actually. It wasn't so much a threat assessment, it was a simplified model. This was a very crude way of enumerating the threat levels, totally invalid and unreliable from a statistical probabilistic point of view, and deliberate gimmick in order to heighten the fear, really, on issues of public protection. So certainly terrorism domain would invariably score as a threat and would be dependent on the JTAC, the Joint Terrorist Analysis Centre, that invariably had the threat level set as almost imminent and severe. And that was transferable at local circumstances to special branch. Now, although I was late in coming at this, when I realised at that time that 9/11 and 7/7 were not as the government narratives believe, to my mind it completely undermined all the assumptions that had previously held in scoring up the matrix. I was always, as a statistician, opposed to the matrix, but in the light of 9/11 and 7/7, I simply saw it as a gimmick that would actually inverse the terror threat, the real terror threat. And that was the assignment. It wasn't to look at 9/11, it wasn't to look at 7/7, it was to actually comment on the terror threat. And this would be used to allocate resources for special branch and to justify the counter-terrorism strategy, rich picture, it was known, the component part of contest and prevent strategy. And rich picture involved collecting intelligence specifically targeting the Muslim communities, most notably in mosques undercover, potentially, or in university campuses, where there might be an danger of an extreme ideology grabbing hold. So that was the idea of rich picture, and the resources there to allocate as a result of the matrix. Now, I had the dilemma. The assignment was due on the 8th of July, and I woke up to the fact that 9/11 and 7/7 were most probably inside jobs on the 1st of July. Not a lot of time to react, and on the fifth anniversary of July the 7th, I had a crisis of conscience. The next morning, I'm due to present with a board. The boss, I've alerted the boss to the possibility. He didn't want to know, closed all conversations down, told me he wanted me to go to occupational health, but wanted me to go along with the scoring system prior to the awful realisation that 9/11 and 7/7 weren't, as the government narrative would have us believe. So in that situation, the next day at work in the morning, I got in extra early, and because I was cornered by the bosses, they weren't paying, you know, they weren't going to listen to me. I thrust in front of their noses a ludicrously scored front seat strategic threat assessment matrix to reflect the absurd position that they were putting me in. It shot the living daylights out of them. "What's this, Tony?" I said, "That's all you can get unless you allow me to actually expose the truth in the scoring system. And if you can't do that, I can't let a matrix go out in my name. Professional standards for honesty and integrity should not allow me to do that. It's not reasonable for you to instruct me as the analyst to actually lie about the analysis. So it's all or nothing, basically." Knowing that full well that would land me in deep, deep, deep trouble, and it duly did. They asked me to write a report to explain the stance, not to do the analysis. They didn't want to look at the analysis. And I just simply said, "Look, conscience could not permit me to do this. Professional standards, and I had a belief. There were component parts that were philosophical too, but basically the blockage was data analysis on, you know, the empirical data that really points more towards an inside job than the government narrative that 23 suicidal maniacs actually committed 9/11 and 7/7.
Look, Tony, whereabouts were you working and what was your job?
Well, I was the principal intelligence analyst at South Yorkshire Police. Now, South Yorkshire Police, that's Sheffield, Barnsley, Doncaster, Rotherham, some Muslim communities. It's a reasonably large police force. There was 45 intelligence analysts. I was head of profession, so I linked in with other principal intelligence analysts. So I was the strategic analyst. I wasn't the specialist in special branch. I don't want to sort of portray myself as a terror threat analysis with first-hand information. But I was dependent on special branch analysts to give me sanitized reports. The problem in that respect was that their analysis invariably just followed the government rhetoric. Never once deviated for it. Now, once the government narrative came into doubt in my mind, I could no longer trust the information that Special Branch were giving me in a sanitised way.
So what does this say for your profession as a whole? Because you don't see droves of police intelligence analysts coming out and saying this.
You don't see droves. I've not seen anybody since. They've all kept very quiet. I dare say that they know about me now, and I rather suspect that they have been frightened off speaking because of what they've seen done to me.
Well, that's right. I mean, what did you feel when you saw yourself attacked by the Sun?
I took the view, when the Sun came knocking on the door, Tony, you were the first person I contacted, and on the 8th of July 2011, you broadcast news of my... I'd kept the case close to my chest for nearly a full year since the stance. So I didn't go blur. I wasn't like out of control here. I was hoping that this could, you know, be a solution within. That never came about. So I blurted out on your program, and at the same time, Richard Hall. Then next day, the Sun came knocking at the door, uninvited, and I was only too happy to speak with them. I knew that it was risky. When they actually did a character assassination job on me and got in the Sun, I took the view that any publicity on this is better than none. The objective was for exposure, and if I had to take a hit a little bit by letting the Sun ridicule my beliefs and misrepresent everything, so be it. So it didn't really affect me. I wasn't upset by what the Sun did. I found it quite funny, to be frank.
Okay, now what happened yesterday?
Well, yesterday was an interesting thing because it not specifically to do with my case. Not so long ago, I wrote to my Barnsley Metropolitan Borough Council saying that under Section 15 of the Terrorism Act 2000, if you've got reasonable cause to suspect an organisation is involved in terrorist activity, then it is a criminal offence under that Act for you to give any money to it or support to it. And a gentleman called Tony Rook took this up with the Home Office and said, can you confirm that that Act is still in existence? And it was. So therefore, I picked up that and said, I'm not prepared to commit an offence because I have got reasonable cause to suspect that our government was involved in some shape or form as in acts of state terror regarding the London bombings and subsequent miscarriages of justice. Also, as the principal intelligence analyst, South Yorkshire Police know I had reasonable cause to suspect that. Similarly, the abject failure of South Yorkshire Police to investigate my allegations of state corruption and involving terrorist activity, bearing in mind in South Yorkshire itself, in Sheffield, on the 5th of July 2005, there was a terror hoax drill, and also on the 11th, and Chief Constable Meredith Hughes at the time was actually running the show up at Glen Eagles, where there was a hoax. Now, bearing in mind all the statesmen, Bush and all the key people in Europe, with Tony Blair, were at Glen Eagles and on the 7th of July. It was Meredith Hughes that had the responsibility for looking after that show. Now, also, post 7/7, and most people wouldn't know this, but Meredith Hughes had a senior position with the post management of 7/7. But if 7/7 was an inside job, then my chief constable at the time, who never spoke to me about 7/7, kept me at arm's length, has done something, in my opinion, that actually perpetrates the cover-up and the concealment of state crimes in association with terrorism. Now, that to my mind is more than justification for me to make the stance. So I was up in front of the magistrates' court, and now, within their powers, they weren't able to do anything about that. They looked totally stunned, and they served a notice on me, a liability notice. So the next thing that's going to happen is that they'll be at the door, the bailiffs, because I'm not budging on this. So they're going to retrieve my council tax either through the bailiffs or, if that fails, imprisonment.
Okay, Tony, what's next then?
Well, today I was in the Employment Appeal Tribunal. This case is not finished yet. I didn't win the employment trial. I had QC Michael Simpson represented me today. It was a superb display between the judge and Michael. In the end, I didn't win, but the door is still open for the Court of Appeal, and it's open through the Public Interest Disclosure Act. The reason why it's still open is that if you think back to the unfair dismissal hearing where I was represented not by a barrister but by Ian R. Crane as a layperson, where Ian first broached, in principle at least, the Public Interest Disclosure Act. Now, it wasn't raised under that legislation because Ian didn't know the law because he wasn't a trained lawyer. So we were raising a new issue today, and the reason why the door is still open is a point of law, is because I did not have legal representation to bring, and so bringing this new issue to the table, we can go on a point of appeal, and my analysis of 7/7, for instance, and 9/11 is all on show in the courts already. So if we do actually win in the Court of Appeal, it goes back to the drawing board, and instead of actually fighting this out originally, which we did was on a philosophical belief that may have been protected, this will be on the veracity of the analysis about 7/7 and 9/11. In terms, and the matrix, the strategic threat matrix that I was saying is totally gimmicky and skewing, almost inverting the resources and the actual threat. So I was making a public, I would allege I was making a Public Interest Disclosure Act. So this case has still got a long, long way to run, Tony, and each step it gets, it's going to be more high profile. So we came out, although we lost, we're delighted that the door is still open.
Okay, Tony Farrell, well, where can people go to find out more about your case?
Well, get ready, because very shortly there's going to be some, and within the next sort of week there will be a film out on this, and also Nick Collison's website will be covering it. I myself will have a website up and running within around about a fortnight with all this information on the case. But at the moment, I haven't got those details. So if you want
okay,
to
no, that's
look
fine.
At it, there's Terror on the Tube, But look out for the documentary that will be out very shortly.
Okay, and can you just point us to something in the past that makes you think that it is possible for NATO, Mossad, these Western intelligence services to do something like 7/7, or at least to be involved in terrorism, blowing up their own people? Because the thing that worries me is that this is the exact thing that President Assad of Syria and President Gaddafi of Libya have been accused of.
Well, yeah, I mean, Martin comments, frequently comments on Operation Gladio. And of course, all that element in the 1980s was essentially false flag. So it's nothing new. I think people are beginning to wake up to it as time goes on. But I think we need greater exposure. Hopefully this case now is getting high profile and can help that cause in some way. Certainly having a barrister of the quality of Michael Shrimpton will help no end. The quality in the courtroom today was second to none. Everybody, the courthouse was packed, and everybody was astounded by the level of debate. So we all came out buoyant, even though it didn't go our way today.
Tony Farrell, thanks very much for joining us.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Okay, now I'm joined by Martin Summers. Quickly, Martin, we've had a... last weekend we were talking about the Spanish possibly avoiding the bailout, and then they didn't. How's things going with the whole euro crisis?
Well, it's obviously coming to a head. The Spanish bailout was lasted about 12 hours before the Viagra wore off, and we had coitus interruptus again. Basically, we're on the brink now. I think that it's unlikely that the European governments are going to get their act together to carry on bailing the banks out, not least because they haven't got any money. And the Greek elections on Sunday, I understand Forex markets have been closed down around the world because they're expecting an explosion. So by Monday, we could see the banks toppling.
We're talking about a real, I mean, effectively a loan shark scheme by the, what is it, the Troika? And who are the Troika?
Well, the Troika are trying to enforce, it's the EC, the European Central Bank, the IMF, and I can't remember the third one. It'll come to me in a moment. The point is that all of this talk, people are failing to understand what the real problem is here. If there is a disorderly default in Greece, the banking system will collapse. Which means next week, folks, when you go to the hole in the wall, it might just eat your card and not give you any money because you've lost your money. That's the sort of thing that can and maybe will happen.
Well, Greek blogger Yanis Varoufakis was on the Kaiser Report this week explaining how the European Troika lend money to countries like Greece, and then they're taking it back at actually a higher level of interest. The other thing is they're getting special discounts on this money. So for a longer that this whole euro crisis can be drawn out, the more money they make and the more money they suck out of Greece. Pretty scary, but let's have a listen to that now.
The Greek government, 2.5 weeks, borrowed 4.2 billion from one arm of the European Union, from the EFSF, in order to give it wholesale to the ECB so that the ECB could profit from the bankruptcy of the Greek state while the Greek population was being screwed to the ground. That is Ponzi austerity.
Okay, so you have the population being forced to accept austerity, plus more debt at the same time, plus the specter of the people who are perpetrating this Ponzi scheme enriching themselves with billions of dollars by manufacturing and selling and constructing this Ponzi austerity scheme. And there's an election coming up in Greece in a few days. Yanis, the new government, what's the first thing they should do day one? Whoever gets into office, what should they do?
One thing: announce that Greece is not going to accept the next loan installment from the Troika. Look into the eyes of the German taxpayer and say, you are backstopping these loans to us. Those loans are not helping us restore our economic activity, our society, keep our hospitals running. Those loans we have to take unsustainably and give them back to the ECB or to somebody, some other creditor. Now, we are not going to be able to keep doing this because we are, sort of collapsing and imploding. So your good money is going to be thrown after bad money, and in all consciousness, and on the basis of just simple solidarity of one European to another, we, the Greek taxpayers, the Greek government, are looking at you, the German taxpayers, and saying, we are not going to accept this money. And if this means we're going to come, we're going to go bankrupt, well, so be it, because we are bankrupt. We have to find another way of making this Eurozone of ours work, or let it just go to hell.
Well, Martin, it's almost like Angela Merkel sitting there in Germany with her arms folded, looking down on Greece and seeing this almost, you know, for her and for the Germans, surely this is actually quite good. The longer it's drawn out, the more the more positive this is for Germany, no?
People seeing this as Germany versus Greece, or Greece versus Germany, they didn't vote for each other in the Eurovision Song Contest, is missing the point. If Greece just says we're not going to pay and we can't pay, the banking system in Germany, in France, and in Britain will collapse. It's extraordinary because Greece only represents 2% of European GDP, never mind international GDP. And just Greece saying no is enough to bring down the entire banking system. Just wait till Spain, Italy, and Portugal say no. It's an absolute dead cert that at some point, very soon, the banks, will, the derivatives market is going to implode. They will find that all the counterparties don't exist. And this whole mountain of debt will disappear like the Wicked Witch of the West having a bucket of water thrown over her. And that's the good news. The bad news is that means our living standards, our way of life, our children's future going down the drain at the same time. But that's the mess we've got ourselves into by bailing out criminal, insolvent banks.
Okay, Martin. Now, I'm joined by Wilf Mound from Bristol Greenpeace. Hi, Wilf. Welcome to Drive Time.
Welcome. Thank you very much for inviting us.
Now, first of all, how did you personally get into environmental campaigning, Wilf?
Well, it was a long story, starting from my early childhood and growing up in Westside Portsmouth and going around Whale Island and fishing and so forth, and then ending up with cut feet as we jumped in and found that the sailors dumped swarf where we were swimming, and we all got upset about that and thought that there should be a better solution to put your swarf somewhere. And then when I did my apprenticeship, I started to see how the dockyard, which at that time had 27,000 people, treated the environment, you know, with enormous wastage. You know, you do a whole load of work and it'd have to be ripped out because they wanted to do something else. And it went on from there. And then you started to get things percolating through about the state of the country in general, the way that the rivers were poisoned. You had the great, I'm 72 now, so I remember the great smog in London and the fact that it killed people, and that did seem to say we're doing something wrong here. And then once you carry on from there, you see that there's all sorts of other things, like the carelessness with which workers were treated in various industries, no safety, and of course a great example of that, you know, is where any fine particulates were around and people ended up with pneumoconiosis and so forth.
So do you think there's any kind of real nub of a cause to the environmental problems that we're faced with today? I mean, certainly in the 60s and 70s there was a lot of talk about pollution. At the end of the day, what's causing, do you think, if there is anything?
Human beings and their commercial activities through corporations who think that the environment is a dumping ground, something to exploit. I mean, we currently are campaigning a 3-year international campaign against shale drilling in the Arctic. You know, it's because they see the summer melt as an opportunity to go and drill without thinking downstream what happens when it refreezes, when it then melts again and you have large icebergs heading towards your equipment and causing an oil spill, which an oil spill in the Arctic will wipe out the whole of the life there.
Okay, so what's going on anyway with this current campaign with fishing rights around the southwest?
Well, this is again the very sort of highly motivational cause for campaigning here is the state of the oceans and the way that they've been predated with the fish stocks, and the fact that, you know, around the UK, we're subject to the Common Fisheries Policy. The Common Fisheries Policy is rotten to the core, as you may have seen if you've followed any of Hugh's fish fight things. He explained it very well with the quotas and the fact that you have to throw a certain amount away, and therefore you throw them away dead and they don't reproduce. And
now, this has been in the news this week, hasn't it? Particularly,
yes.
That they're saying that there's quite a lot of people now saying that that's going to stop happening over a period over the next couple of years.
Well, besieged the meeting in Luxembourg earlier in the week, and that's on the web, which was a fisheries thing. We're currently running a campaign, Be a Fisherman's Friend, which is linking up with the Southwest Coastal Fishermen who operate in under 10-metre boats, because they are low-impact and sustainable fishermen who have an essential contribution to the local economy.
But how are they ever, in those little fishing boats, going to compete with the massive factory ships, the massive trawlers?
Well, because we have to reduce, in the immediate term and medium term, we have to reduce the consumption. So that the fish, I mean, Greenpeace advocate marine reserves, and like Lundy Island was one, and it's replenished itself, and it's a great example. But there are loads of others throughout the world. We just need to negotiate them around the rest of the coast in the UK and Europe, and we have to tread water so that we don't consume in the way, and we certainly don't waste in the way that we do. And so we've joined up with the new Under 10 Fishermen's Association, which is unusual.
Sorry, the Under 10 Fishermen?
New Under 10s.
What does that mean?
It's under 10 metres.
Oh, okay. Not, okay.
Not,
not, not the children's
fishermen.
Age,
no.
Okay. Sound like the Sea Scouts or something.
Yeah. These are the 10-metre boatmen who are 77% of the UK fishing workforce, but they only get 4% of the quota because of the way that the corporations can negotiate and convert the quotas to themselves through a number of means which are not entirely respectable.
Okay, so what are you actually doing?
Well, we're out on the streets. We've been out on the streets since May the 12th. We do stalls. We did Love Food last week and got 271 signatures on the petition, which we will be giving to Mr. Fox, the MEP, in order to pressure him and in the meetings that are coming up in September, October.
In your experience, though, do the MPs and the MEPs really listen? Because I think one of the things I quite like about Greenpeace is the fact that when they are not listening to politicians, Greenpeace take action.
Well, we as I say, we did take action last week at the meeting in Luxembourg. We obviously will be looking at that in lots of other ways, but that's always reported after the event rather than before, although press releases are given out with an embargo. But we have to do those things with a lot of high degree of confidence, because quite often nowadays all these meetings, as you will know, covered by security and so forth, so we have to find ways around that. But we certainly will be doing direct actions, I'm absolutely sure of that. But the campaigning is an essential part, because there are so many fish festivals along the southwest coast where we can inform the public. Bristol has an enormous number. We're at Bristol Festival of Nature tomorrow and Sunday. We're at St. Werburgh's Festival tomorrow. We were at the Ecoside trial earlier today, wearing our fish. I don't know if you've seen any of that.
Tell us about that then.
Well, about what?
The Ecoside trial, what's that?
The Ecoside trial is Polly Higgins bringing charges against governments of the past 10 years for neglect of the environment. And it had Charles Redfern from Fish Forever, along with others, submitting evidence to suggest that governments have been pretty poor in protecting the environment, despite the rhetoric.
So what's going on overall then around the southwest, particularly? I mean, we all love these little fishing villages. Is there really any future, much of a future, for fishing families, for the traditional type of fishermen?
This is the thrust of our campaign, to maintain these people, because they are an essential part of the local economy.
But we know that, but are they still under threat even now? I mean, so they've been whittled down to a shadow of their former self, aren't they?
Yes, but I mean, that could be even worse. I mean, it's analogous to the fact that the southwest farming communities have generally been small family farms, and they're being forced off primarily because of the gate price of milk that the supermarkets forced down and down, so that now small family farmers can't make a living, and therefore they give up. And that we have to try and prevent with the small under 10 fishermen.
Okay, where and when does Bristol Greenpeace meet?
We meet the first Wednesday of every month at 8 p.m. in the Victorian Methodist Church at 1A White Ladies Road, next to the Southwest Regional College of Art, I think it's called, or Academy of Art, opposite the Victoria Rooms.
Okay.
From the BBC.
And if they wish to, how do listeners get in touch?
Well, you can Google
or use your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google.
Well, that's the only one I know. because I'm averse to all this, but you can put in the Bristol Greenpeace group and you should come up with the details of us and our website.
Okay, Wilf Mound, thanks very much from Bristol Greenpeace.
Thank you very much for having me.
On BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
You live your life in the songs you hear on the rock and roll radio. And when a young girl doesn't have any friends, that's a really nice place to go. Folks hoping you'd turn out cool, but they have to take you out of school. You're a little touched, you know, ain't you, baby? Lovers appear in your room each night and they whirl you across the floor. But they always seem to fade away when your daddy taps on your door. Angie girl, are you all right? Like he walked into a play, and the music's so loud it spins him around till his soul has lost its way. And as she turns the volume down, he's getting smaller with the sound. It seems to pull him off the ground toward the radio he's found, never to be found. Disappeared, and everyone thinks he died. Except a crazy girl with a secret lover who keeps her satisfied. It's so nice to be insane, no one asks you to explain. Radio by your side, and your baby.
Helen Reddy from a long time ago there. I hope she's not referring to Angela Merkel, and Martin will probably tell us whether she is or not a little bit later on. But right now I'm joined by the South West Rep on the National Executive of the Transport Salaried Staff Association, better known as the TSSA, Bill Monteith. Hi Bill, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
First of all, what is the TSSA?
Transport Salaried Staff Association. We represent most of the managerial grades and clerical grades on the railways throughout the United Kingdom, as well as managerial and clerical grades from around transport industries, people like Thomas Cook. Basically, if it's to do with travel and the management side of the travel industry, we deal with it.
Okay, well, tell us about yourself. What's been your career in transport?
I've been in the railway industry since 1977, so currently my 35th year, I believe. Predominantly until 3 years ago in the grade of driver and the line of promotion up to driver, and I moved into the management grade just over nearly 4 years ago.
Okay, so what, you're driving trains, what sort of trains?
HSTs, I've even dabbled in steam from time to time, but basically, if you're old enough to remember the heyday of railways and railways in the 70s, 80s, 90s, then I've driven most of that.
Okay. Now, just from a sort of practical point of view, is that it's a lot of responsibility with a great big train. You are the only person. I mean, we were talking about this earlier on, actually, weren't we, Martin? Where we were saying, talking about automatic trains. This is something that apparently that BAE Systems are working on, automatic transport systems, you know, planes that fly themselves, these drones. What's your feeling? I mean, I imagine you're a little bit biased, having been a train driver yourself, about the idea of automating these things, because we've got things like the Docklands Light Railway, haven't we, which is doesn't need a driver.
Absolutely right. And to a limited degree, I think automation of trains probably wouldn't be that too, you know, too much of a contentious issue. But take away the automation of the train, and this will come back to what we talk about later on. Let's talk about the human side of this. When a train is automated on the Docklands Light Railway, it's a sad fact of life. You have people who wish to end their life and things like that. You have children running about on the tracks, young children who don't know better. As part of police cuts, we no longer have policemen who go around to schools and point out the dangers of the transport infrastructure to young children. So while you have a driver who's responsive up the front, a human pair of eyes who can bring that train to a stand, either escort the child to safety or minimise the risk of danger to that child or person who wishes to harm themselves, that is something that an automated train cannot do. And tube drivers on the underground are well aware of how many lives have been saved by having the vigilance of the human interface at the front end of the train. It's automation's great, but you will pay a heavy price in human life for that.
Now, under Conservative Prime Minister John Major, railways were privatised. Can you just give us an idea? Because for many of us, you know, we just buy the ticket as we always used to do. How are they actually organised now? Because I know there's several tiers of ownership, aren't there, between the actual track and you buying a ticket and getting on a train?
I mean, I must speak from a personal point of view that I am anti-privatisation because of my political background and beliefs, but, and there is a big caveat to this, I am not wholly anti-privatisation. And handled correctly, privatisation has its place. It has a role in the way we go. I'm very anti the fact that a public utility or a social necessity such as transport is put out to privatisation, but that is one of my own personal beliefs. However, and we'll go back to John Major's government, when they privatised it, they couldn't have come up with a more ham-fisted, cack-handed way of handling a privatisation. We've ended up with that many layers of bureaucracy, interface between train operators. We no longer have a cohesive, rational service that actually serves the end user. And the end user, at the end of the day, is the travelling public.
Come on, the end user.
We've lost sight of the fact that the person that we're meant to be serving is not being served in the best possible measure.
Okay, but what about the, you know, who owns the track, who owns the trains, who owns the stations, for example, now?
The stations are owned predominantly by Network Rail, but they are leased. Network Rail run the principal stations such as London Paddington, Birmingham New Street. They actually own the infrastructure of the railway itself. But for instance, in this area, First Great Western lease those stations back from Network Rail. The locomotives, the rolling stock, the carriages are all owned, believe it or not, by our good friend the banks under the nom de plume of Roscoe's, which is Rolling Stock Companies. There are actually 27 train operating companies all competing for business around the country. It's an absolute mishmash. It's the most unbelievably inefficient privatisation. Privatisation possibly could have worked. The way it was privatised from day one meant it could not possibly work.
It sounds to me as if there's quite a lot of different layers, as I say, between the track and between buying a ticket. You've got lots of different firms that are dealing with each other, and everyone is taking their cut. Everyone has got their directors, everyone's got their shareholders. Absolutely. That they've got to pay off. And so when you're buying your ticket, it's almost like there's lots and lots of people taking a bit of value out of that before you're actually getting your journey. But anyway, what we're here to talk about today is this thing called the McNulty Report, which came out a few weeks ago. Can you just tell us who is McNulty and what is his report about?
Sir Roy McNulty formerly worked for British Airport Authority.
Now that makes me nervous to start with, because knowing the way that the airports in this country, I mean, for example, at Heathrow was a complete disaster with Terminal 5. They've also had an awful situation where people are arriving and finding that there's the ceilings are leaking, they've got buckets collecting water. So he doesn't necessarily sound like the sort of the right kind of guy to do this necessarily, having made a bit of a hash of British Airports Authority.
Well, I think it's fair to say that if the tenets of the McNulty report actually come to fruition, which I suspect that they will, then all I can say is you ain't seen nothing yet.
So what is he saying in his report? Well, how is he going to transform the railways in his mind's eye?
For a start, the McNulty report is fundamentally flawed. It says what the government wants it to say. I have to lay my cards on the table at the start here and say there's actually nothing wrong with trying to make the railways more efficient. The railways are very inefficient, and they're inefficient because the way they were privatised. There are cost savings to be made, and there are huge cost savings to be made. McNulty has ignored the obvious way, and that is the reintegration of the transport system back into public ownership with one tier of management supervising the whole lot. And he's gone along the lines of saying privatisation was good, it worked. Well, that is fundamentally wrong to start with. But what he's saying is now, because the railways need to affect cost savings, we're going to affect those cost savings by taking away guards on trains. We're going to close ticket offices, and we're going to move into smart ticketing. Very similar to the way you can buy your airline ticket on the internet. Well, you can do that already for the railway. You can, like an Oyster card, you can top the thing up online, you can go to the train station, you can touch the thing. Contactless technology. Sounds great in principle. Removal of guards, removal of ticket offices. Basically, driver-only operation trains becomes the default position. What you're actually doing is targeting the wrong people. If you're going to make the savings in the inefficient layer. Don't take it away from frontline staff, because at the end of the day, the travelling public need to interface with frontline staff. I'll just paint you a little picture here. You stood on Stapledon Road or Lawrence Hill platform on a cold winter's evening, and there may or may not be a crowd of people that make you feel uneasy. You're a young single mother, maybe have a small toddler with you. You're going to get on a train. That should be a place of safety. You haven't bought a ticket because there's no ticket office there, and you've got to get off at Bristol Temple Meads where there are ticket barriers, but you're made to feel very uneasy. Is CCTV going to intervene if something should happen? You get on the train, the bolt hole when it comes in, so that you can feel safe in the train. But there's no guard. The only person on that train is the driver. You get to Bristol Temple Meads, you go to the barriers, and there's somebody there that says, you haven't bought a ticket, and you get charged the full whack fare for that. Is that really serving the end user? I very much doubt that the financial case for McNulty will yield any saving at all. It will certainly dissuade people from travelling, because the travelling experience will be gone. People need that human interface. And that's how he's targeting the saving, is to take away the human interface. And that is fundamentally wrong. Take away the waste and the mismanagement.
Which is where?
For a start, we'll go back a little bit historically, if I've got time to do that. British Rail, much maligned, much panned. The public had bought the trains. The trains were on their last legs. They were worn out, in theory. There were some new trains about, but in the majority, they were getting time expired. Under privatisation, the track was split off to our old friend Rail Track, of not too fond memory. The rolling stock was given to rolling stock leasing companies, who very soon sold them off to the banks. Now, bearing in mind that they paid, on a cost book analysis, very little, if not anything, for these time expired stock. If you now wanted to run a service, you have the right to say, I'm going to run the BCFM rail service around this area. So you go to the government, you put a safety case together, and you become what is known as a train operator. You then have to hire that stock, which you already owned. You have to hire that back from the banks, and you're paying top dollar for that. You then have to pay Network Rail to run the train on the track. If there are any delays, you end up paying other operators for that. But you've got your own accountants, your own managers, your own delay attributors. There is so many layers all over the system. And at the end of the day, all we ask for in this country is an integrated transport network. People are becoming more and more reliant on public transport. And this system is so fundamentally flawed, it cannot deliver an integrated transport network.
Okay, Bill, you've worked at the coalface. You know railways pretty much inside out. How do we, in one fell swoop, change things for the better? If you really were in, not just in McNulty's boots, but in the transport secretary's boots, how could you transform things to actually start putting things back on, hate to use the cliche, the right track? How do we actually send things in the right direction here? Because clearly it's a mess. There's lots of people on the take. It's a bit of a racket now. There's so many people with their fingers in the till. Everyone's, you know, got their own little bureaucracies, and the customer is paying far, far more. The passenger, shall I say, is paying far, far more than they should be for travelling around. And of course, this is causing people to buy cars, use the cars far more than necessary. So what would you like to do to transform it if you had, you were in the transport secretary's shoes?
There is one simple, solitary answer to that, and that is the renationalisation of the railway network. The railway network is a service for the public across the country. It's not for people in the southwest, it's not for people in an isolated pocket in the Midlands, it's for everybody in the country. It is a national treasure. It needs to have a national, holistic view taken of it. And this hogwash, and I have to refer to it as hogwash, that it would take too much, it would cost the public far too much to renationalise the railway, is an utter, complete red herring. British Rail actually still exists. Believe it or not, they still exist as an entity. They own isolated pockets of land, but they also have an operating arm. If one of the franchisees defaults with the franchise, British Rail, under their operating arm, step back in and take it back, technically, into public ownership until they can find somebody else to take the franchise on. Or in other words, you've paid us X number of billions of pounds, you failed in the franchise, we've taken it back into public ownership, we will now advertise for somebody else to come back and pay us billions to run it. It's a money-making scam. But the thing is, when a franchise comes up, at the end of the franchise, it's quite simple. You turn around and say, we're retaining ownership of it. There's no payments to shareholders. Nothing.
Martin, is that feasible, and has it been done elsewhere?
Absolutely. And what you do is, they're talking now about allowing them to charge what they like, but of course you just say, no, you can't do that because we're going to regulate you, and therefore you're not making a profit, therefore you're making a loss, and then of course it's a bankrupt company.
Absolutely.
And you don't have to pay for that. You just take it over. And of course this was very important in New Zealand in the early 80s. The so-called Labour government in New Zealand privatised their small railways, and that was a very clear indication of the direction they were taking the Labour Party in New Zealand. I'm glad to say the Labour Party in New Zealand didn't stand for that. They smashed the existing Labour Party. The trade unions withdrew the funding. They rebuilt it. They brought in PR. And the first thing they did, as soon as you got the new, what they call the new Labour government in New Zealand, they renationalised the railways on day one. It was a signal of the direction of travel of the whole policy of the government.
OK, Bill, final word. Is this going to happen or not?
I fear that it is. And the only way that it will be stopped is...
This is McNulty, not the renationalisation.
No. I'm talking about McNulty. The thing is, the government have been very, very coy about this. It will never be enacted. It is a command paper, and when the government asks companies to tender for franchises, they are saying quite clearly that you will adopt all of the fundamental points in McNulty. So the government can then stick their hands up when it all goes horribly wrong and people start saying, where's our guards, where's our ticket offices, why, you know, why is there no safety on the railways? They can put their hand up and say, well, it wasn't us. Exactly the same as they did with Serple in the 80s. The only way we can do this is with a coordinated grassroots campaign for the public to say, we are not going to stand for this. We want ticket offices. We want people on trains. We need to feel safe.
Okay, so where do the public go to get hold of this campaign, which is obviously rolling, even if it is a bit slow at this moment?
Well, firstly, people need to understand McNulty, and it is quite a heavyweight document, so just Google McNulty, you'll find
out. Or use your other search engine, not necessarily Google.
Well, yep. Or whatever search engine you wish to use. Just look up McNulty and find out.
Okay.
But if you want to know about the campaign, go to tssa.org, where there is a coordinated campaign amongst all the rail unions and all the transport organisations, where they can actually find out more about McNulty and how we can actually coordinate the grassroots campaign to fight this iniquitous, very damaging report.
Okay, well, Bill Monteith, South West Rep on the National Executive of the Transport Salaried Staff Association, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Okay, Martin, very quickly, Bilderberg, the Evening Standard, is saying that the BBC's, one of the BBC's trustees, now this is the secret rulers of the Western world, effectively a kind of secret government associated with NATO, but the Marcus Agius, who's also the chairman of Barclays Bank, has been at the Bilderberg group, but the BBC themselves didn't report anything about it.
Well, the Evening Standard, as you say, did report about it, and so did the Guardian website. And I believe there was something in the Daily Mail about Bilderberg this year, wasn't there?
There was.
For the very first time. For many years, the Bilderbergers pretended they didn't exist. Now they hand out press releases.
Okay, well, we were going to go to the news. We're not going to go to the news. We're going to have some music. And then, very much coming up after that, we've got Pat Hart and his Fresh Blood Party, followed by the UFO.